Grace Hour daily program that takes a dive into the believer's daily challenges and helps him learn his faith in a practical way. My name is Tom Schaller, and I'm joined with Matt DiSirio here in the studio. Today we'll be talking about reaching the secular world with the gospel. With love, with compassion, with knowledge, and care. And so, as we start, I think it's going to be very informal. Pastor Matti and I just talking as friends. He has a lot of experience. He's from Finland, which is a secular country. And he's lived in a number of different countries, different kinds of cultures and backgrounds. And as a messenger of Christ, both of us serious believers in what God has said in the world. And I think that with our understanding of the Bible and our understanding of the faith, we are able to, with love, look at a secular worldview and address some of the needs. So based on our understanding of what the world secular worldview is, we're able to help believers relate to them and reach them somehow, and then also we learn from them we understand that if there's inconsistencies in our way of thinking, if we don't have hope, really deep rooted hope in a transcendent world, then that leaves us with some kind of great need, you know. So let's start our program.
All right. Okay.
I think that it's interesting to look at this theme because we are not really talking about atheism only. Atheism is clear. I mean, philosophy, anti-God, no God, and trying to explain everything without any creator and without any involvement of God. And that's clear. I mean, I sometimes say this jokingly, but you say to an atheist that the only difference between you and me is that God lives in me and doesn't live in you, and the atheist gets offended and says, "What do you mean God doesn't live in me? Well, what are you talking about?" Like, you know, because it doesn't go really deep. It's just it's just rebellion. But when we are talking about secularism, we are talking about a more complex matter in that sense that even a church can become secular. And our Christian, so-called Christian culture can become secular. A Christian country can become secular. And we've seen that in Europe. We see it all the time, of course. And so it means that we kind of accept or admit that God is in the background, but we are not involving him too much. And we definitely don't need him. But he's allowed to be there in the background, and the question is God going to agree with that, or is he going to do something to shake that kind of setting up, you know, and saying like you are just deceived, you know, don't you know that I gave you your life and I am, like, you know, your creator, and I am your shepherd, the shepherd of your soul, and I care and I'm involved. Even if you don't recognize any of it, I'm totally involved. And you go to visit someone at the deathbed, and you know that is true.
Yeah.
That if God is not in, God says, that's it then.
You made a statement earlier about near truth. Could you explain that?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that, how sometimes in the name of practicality, you know, people refuse to get involved in some problems or refuse to think. Like, as believers, I believe we, as born-again believers, we all are called to have a world vision. And somebody could say, well, I have enough problems in my own family, and I'm trying to just, like, you know, make the ends meet, and I'm just limiting my life, and I cannot go there. I cannot think about other countries, or I cannot think about the next town, or I cannot even think about my next door neighbor because I have to limit my life to this world. And it's kind of, I call it the near truth, so that I choose to just limit my involvement. And it sounds like a synonym for practicality. And I recalled, like, in Nazi Germany, that was the situation when the Jewish people were taken to the concentration camps, and then they were, you know, taken to their labor camps, you know, through the towns, these rosy German towns where everybody is just having a nice life and eating pork and dressing, talking about the latest fashion and very much like ignoring what was going on. And in a way, like this idea of near truth, they chose not to get involved or see it, but that near truth was no more a truth, but it was actually a lie. And how this can happen. And then when the Americans came and liberated those camps, and they saw what was happening, so there was a story how they brought the town people to see these people, and the people were taken out from the camps, and they were skeletons, and they made the people to stand there and look at them and see them, that mm-hmm. how could you not see these people? Mm-hmm. They were daily going through your city. Mm-hmm. But it was this concept of near truth that I had to protect myself. I could not help anyways. I could not change anything anyways. So I'm just going to live my rosy life. And the truth, so-called near truth, became a lie.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in the secular world, you know, let's say in Europe, here in the United States, we are moving away from God, and in secularism, you really make man the center. So man knows better. There's the idea that man has the technology, can manage the economy, can generate new economical prosperity. We can accomplish a lot of things. So there's that hope in man. And then we know historically that man has such great deficiencies and problems. Like now we hear a lot about social injustice, racism, economical differences between one class of people and another. And the humanists are saying these things are wrong. These things need to be changed. And so as they dive in, we find also like hypocrisy. Mm. You know, the very people that might be talking about it are also the ones that are struggling with what is right and what is wrong.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's amazing that Nazi Germany, if we want to use that as an example, the Germans just were able to justify an injustice, you know, genocide. I wouldn't say all of the Germans, mm-hmm. but in principle, they believed that the Jews were the problem and the murder and all that happened. So can you see the problems that humanists have regarding life and the making evaluations about what is right and what is wrong? And they can justify wrong things because they lack the absolute reference. They have a reference to absolute truth.
Yeah, if you try to get rid of the God factor in your society or in your own thinking, then you have to throw out so many things, because those are kind of valuable things that we have received from this understanding that there is God, such as love, unconditional love, forgiveness, you know, mercy, grace, you know, faith as a phenomenon itself. None of them make sense without God, right?
Yes.
So they are, and if you have a society, you might say, okay, we want to define everything without God, and when we can kind of measure everything, and they call it science, that we measure everything and we define everything without God. This is called science, because the idea is that if I can measure it and define it, then I can control it. But that's where man goes so wrong. You know, then he's like, you know, like organizing everything on his table, and then an earthquake comes. And his knowledge doesn't reach so far. Yeah. So his table where he has all these plans drawn is shaking all of a sudden, which is an amazing, I mean, it's an amazing picture, because we are so used to think that there are elements that are stable and always there, but maybe a secular person doesn't admit that they came from someone and from somewhere, such as the earth, for example. You've been flying, and you are always so happy when you land, because you feel that now you are safe and secure. You are not up in the air, you know, on nothing, or you've been sailing in the sea, and when you come land, you know, then you are happy again because something. But then your earth is shaking, or your home that used to be the most secure place in your life, and it collapsed. And that's like, you know, causing you to face this thing that actually there is a life that is beyond that can be controlled.
Mm.
And that leads us to faith, and that leads us to this, which I call soft values. Like, if you ignore these soft values in a society, you become a very, maybe technical, maybe very cold society, which I think easily we could see that happen, like all the technology today and all our achievements and so on. But still, like, you know, people who are running those machines, and they still fall in love, and they still get offended, and they still have like deeper needs for another kind of life.
Yes.
And this is where what God represents and has given to us, right?
Mm-hmm. Would you say a family kind of represents the soft values?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Can you define that a little more?
Maybe that because there is okay, when we talk about a family, or I think altogether in life, that a good word to define life is relationship. Like, this is all about relationship, and sin is a relationship problem. You know, our purpose, our motivation comes from a relationship. Like, I just to give you an example, I work with art, and I have an art gallery in Muscat, and we do a new exhibition every month, so there's a lot of work, and we have different pieces of art, and I love actually doing that. I have found that I actually can do something like that. So when you put the pieces of art together, when you hang an exhibition, it has to be done in a certain way. If it is done in a wrong way, it looks horrible. But then you, like, I usually work on it, like, you know, 3-4 hours just to get like those 10 pictures into right relationship with one another. And even a bad or poor quality or not so good piece of art can excel if it is next to a good piece that is, like, you know, helping that poor piece to excel. And this is an amazing phenomenon, because you that's why in our group exhibitions we involve both professional artists and also amateur artists, and the amateur artist can come in their works, because, and it can be the other way around also, but just when they are rightly related,
yes,
they look good.
Okay.
But if they are not rightly related, like, pictures can start fighting, for example, on the wall. You sometimes see that in people's homes when they have not thought about it. They just put something. So the pictures, don't you see there are two pictures fighting on your wall?
Okay.
Yeah, so the relationship, it's like family is like an amazing platform for relationships.
And I guess the secularists would say, well, we have soft values. We also have our families. We want to have love. We want to learn to get along. We want to forgive. We want social justice and so on. And the problem What would you say is the primary problem in the secular world? If we have, what would you say? I think
it comes down to pride, you know, which is independence of God. But I mean, why you are breathing, right? Why don't you admit that you are breathing?
Mm-hmm.
You just don't want to admit it because you don't want to say the word God, yeah. Or God gave me life, or yeah. You know, just don't want to. And it goes to an extreme sometimes. It's just so ridiculous.
Yes.
Because it's impossible for man to explain himself without a creator. It's impossible.
Yeah. You know, if a secular person saying, you know, I don't believe in God, but then they quickly can just say, that's not right. What you did to me was not right. Or you are a racist. Or, you know, that this is wrong. Economical, civil war. And they have very many opinions about things. And you can say, what grounds are you making those judgments? Aren't you borrowing Christian principles and belief in God, or where is your moral standard coming from?
Yeah, if there's no absolute truth, which God is, then those things mean nothing. I can kill you right here and eat you up.
Yes, right.
And you have no foundation to say it's wrong.
Right.
If there is, but of course they go deep into this explanation of the process, of evolutionary process, and into morals and so on. But we are not really excelling morally, I don't think so.
Yeah, well, let's even use that. Like the evolutionary model is that the strong beat and eat the weak. So why wouldn't, let's say, for example, as we know, the weaker members in society could be taken advantage of, could be manipulated, could be destroyed. And according to the theory of evolution, that's the process. So why are you now saying that is wrong?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
But you're like smuggling into your ideology this idea that it is wrong. But where did that come from? Well, it came from, you know, religion. Religion is saying that it is wrong. And where's religion? Religion is coming from the morality in my heart that I know that it's wrong to take advantage of somebody who is more, you know, not as fortunate as I, is weaker than I. So where did your morality come from? Well, it evolved. Well, how did it evolve? Why would the strong eat up the wicked or eat up the weak, and it's written in your heart that you should give mercy to the weak or have compassion on the weak. Don't you believe that? Isn't that what you're saying regarding social injustice?
When you yourself end up in a situation when you depend on other people's forgiveness.
Yeah.
Like, you know, okay, it's might work, this reasoning might work when I'm strong and when I have it, like, you know, I'm healthy and I am like everything is under my control, or everything is like, you know, right more or less, and I know I have a clear mind. But with most of the people, life is not like that. They fail. They fail to keep the standard. Actually, the Bible says all people fail.
Yes.
Yeah. So you can have a very good theory about life, but there's no provision for you to fail in that theory. And this is where the biblical revelation of grace comes into the picture, that actually, like many religions also are that way, that they give you some idea or a theory what you should do, or what you should do to God, what God expects from you. But then when you fail to do that, there's no provision, because there is no understanding of grace and forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
But in Christian faith, that is like the almost like the substance of our life. We live by grace.
Yes. Forgiveness is all the time.
Yeah.
It's in our mentality. It's in our blood, forgiveness.
Absolutely.
We forgive ourselves. We forgive each other. We believe in the God that forgives us. It's true. But in the secular world, they don't have that teaching. It may be spotted here and there. Okay, I decide to forgive because I want to be a nice person, and it's better if I forgive. But that this is also it's the abnormal, or it's the exceptional idea. But for us, it's the way of life. Yeah,
and it's also like difficult. Let's say politicians, like when there's a moral scandal with the politician. A person can be an excellent politician or economist or, you know, leader altogether, but morally totally mess up.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, and that's going to be that way. It's not like, you know, you that everyone is good in everything.
Mm-hmm.
You might be just good in one thing and you excel and you're known to that, but then, yeah, it's like, you know, you might be a great Bible teacher. But you are a horrible husband.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible, I don't know if that's a good word, but I mean poor. You know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have the secular mindset and then the Christian one, and we are saying that the secular world has real problems, and one of the main problems in the secular mindset is purpose. Like, why are we here?
Hmm.
You know, why are we alive? And I think these questions are important.
Absolutely.
And that if we can ask them, you know, what would you say would be a common answer to that question, Pastor?
Hmm.
If you were to ask him, you know, an everyday Finnish, Swedish, Norwegian, Danish, and you know, in our country we say the greatest country in the world is Finland or one of those Scandinavian countries, and why? Quality of life, quality of food, weather, I mean, cleanliness, climate-wise, not polluted. I mean, weather isn't the best, but, and so it's society taking care of you, and so on. But so you take one of these people and just say, why are you alive? What would the answer be?
There cannot be any other answer but very, very temporal.
Yeah.
That I would be happy, that my family would be happy, that I would be comfortable and my family would be comfortable. And it's actually very selfish.
Yeah.
And then there is like this, like, okay, we are a country that receives refugees, political refugees, people escape from horror and wars and they come to our country. And we are proud and we decide if they qualify or not. I that just like, you know, disturbs me, that setting, because it's like, okay, I don't trust you. Your story is not true. And I mean, you could be, I mean, I almost sometimes like would like to. I'm not. I don't want, but it would be interesting to see that the roles change.
Yeah.
That, let's say Finnish people go and look for political asylum in Syria, or somewhere there. Yeah. And it's just like, you know, there's like a false. There's nothing wrong with having a good life. There's nothing wrong with having a comfortable life for you and your family, and I think it's awesome. It's a blessing, and if you recognize that it is a blessing, it's amazing, because then that brings that humility element there. Otherwise, it's just that you say, "I in my own because I'm a smart guy, or I am good in math or something." You know that because of that I have this thing and so on, but it comes to an end. It has no continuity, and I think that's another thing that really disturbs every soul when they understand that this is all coming to an end. Like I was once in southern France, and I went to a museum, and this French lady walked in, and she was probably like, I mean, she was really old. She was like probably like 100 years old. Maybe she was my age, but I think she was really old. But she dressed like a teenager. And I looked at her and I was just so disturbed by that, because she was just like, you know, claiming her beauty, her past beauty, and whatever she used to be, and she just, and I'm careful when I say that, because I'm not judging her, but it was obvious to me that those were not like the proper clothes for her. She was like, you know, holding on to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was working in a hospital in Sweden, and I worked with old people, and they were really like, you know, dying people. But every morning they wanted to dress up to their best dress and the gold and the rings, and it was like heartbreaking to put that rings into these fingers that were crippled and on their way out from the picture.
Got it.
Wow. Yeah, but they were like there and like
right. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
And it's gonna just gonna go through your fingers. You're not gonna get hold of. Cannot keep it.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me of this Greek word telos, which is like we're designed for a purpose.
Mm.
And I once had the idea of you take a Mercedes-Benz automobile, brand new, 500 series, high-quality automobile, and you could use it for many purposes. You know, maybe you've heard me preach on
that. No, I haven't.
But you could, you know, we have ships in the harbor in Baltimore, and you could take a Mercedes and put a chain through the windshield and through the doors and lower it into the sea and use it as an anchor for the ship, you know, like a brand new Mercedes. And in the glove compartment is a manual on what the car is for, how to use the car, how to drive it on the Autobahn, and all of the technology, but it's used in a different way. And I feel like we are talking about the human race, and secularism is got serious problems because they don't identify our purpose.
Hmm.
We are made for the image to the glorify God, but we are instead used to like adorn. We have gold rings and we're getting older or dressed like a teenager or are arrogant or self-inflated in our sense of personal value, which is fading away.
Hmm. Yeah, that is amazing. Just to, and unfortunately, that dialogue or that conversation between the Christian churches and secularism, there is no like, you know, I mean, that is difficult to find that platform, because it becomes so easily just argumental and like, you know, this kind of But what I love about, like, okay, we have been hearing these things about the revival in Kentucky and so on, and we don't really have a clear, like, statement about it, or I have not been there and so on. But what I have seen, like, our young people went there and they came back and they were, like, excited, and they were just, in very simple terms, there was nothing dramatic or sensational.
Yeah.
They were just excited about the presence of God.
Yes.
And this presence of God is a shock to a secular person.
Yes.
Because how do you explain that? And they would say, well, it's just fantasy, it's just imaginations or religious propaganda or blah, 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 blah. But it is not. And something in them, which is called eternity in their hearts, testifies that this is something beyond you, beyond your control, beyond your comprehension. And this is the God factor.
Yeah.
God is present, so present. I mean, really. Like there is this Tikhov, this Soviet cosmonaut who was in
outer space.
And he said that I didn't see God there. And then somebody said that if he would have stepped out from his spaceship, he would have seen God right away.
Yes.
And it has a double meaning, like, you know, because he would have died and seen God right away, or he would really understand how he thought he saw it all.
Yeah.
Because he went a little bit And that's why those movies and those films, when you kind of show a little bit, like, you know, how big is the black hole? Like, the black hole is like 50 million times the size of our sun or something like that. I don't know the numbers, but it's like incredible. The dimensions are like there are not enough zeros to measure it, because it is infinite. It's just like, you know, there. I saw another presentation of the oceans, like the oceans, how you go deeper. And it was three different video clips. And the first one, they went down all the way to 200 meters or something. And then they went to 2,000 meters. And then they went to like 11,000 meters or something. And the deeper they went, the more they understood that we have not discovered this yet. We have not explored this yet. And then I looked at people's comments under it, and every second comment was, this is scary. I'm afraid. This brings a lot of fear into my heart. And may that be, because that is where we should be. We should understand that because of this thunderstorm, you know, I am safe. I am safe and secure because of this thunder. I'm not in danger, because this power, this God who is greater than this thunderstorm, is on my side. And if I don't have that, then I'm just afraid of death, because the fear of death is something that a secular person cannot explain and cannot master at all.
I like what you said about in the Christian church there is secularism. In we go through the motions of our Christianity. We are believing in the doctrines in some measure, as in Sunday school or rote memory. You know, we go through the motions, but what we are looking for is the spirituality of the believer, that he would live like the way you're saying, that we have that, not the assurance of like having life under our control, not the assurance at the table with all my plans are never going to shake, and not the assurance that we know everything. To be honest, sometimes we as believers, we come across as knowing everything, you know, but we don't know. But that's one of our blessings, is that we admit and are sure, you know, we don't have the control on the table, but we are worshipers of God who is in charge, and the Spirit of God giving us peace and love.
Yeah, like this is, I think it's, I see it this way, that deism is like a very common philosophy in Christian churches, meaning that, okay, God is the creator, but he's no more involved. Like, God is the origin, and he's no more involved. And that leads to secularism. Like, churches become secular because everything is controllable. Everything is, like, you know, very secure in human terms. But there is no expectation in faith. There is no need for miracles. Miracles were just for the first century, because people were primitive, ha 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 ha, you know, and they needed, you know, and now we have modern science medicines, and people don't need healings anymore, and that's slung from that time, and now we are so sophisticated in our faith that we don't need to, like, you know, ask for our daily bread, because we just have social security system, or we don't need to pray for our daily bread anymore. And because those are all elements that are expressions of a practical faith, that I depend on God today, and God is not far, but God is present. And to throw this in a little bit, like, you know, in Islam, God is very far. He's like very distant. He's very like, you know, different from us. And that's emphasized, that he is not really, like, you know, present in that sense, that he would be, like, you know, leading you, or even answering your personal prayers.
Wow. Yes. What would you say would be the best way to for a believer to keep himself awake to the spiritual realities of God around me, relating to God in my heart, in my mind, and having a vibrant faith.
You once said, this is a long time ago, maybe it was in a conversation or maybe it was in your message, that you said that your children were still like young, you know, and you said that I wish, you said, I know this is a kind of funny statement, but I wish that my children had suffered more, that they would have seen suffering, because then they would appreciate, you know, things differently. Mm-hmm. And then we spoke about that, how good it is to go to hospitals, go to places where the suffering people are hidden from us, and meet like death face to face, and understand that, hey, this is not to be denied, but we can be prepared, and it's the reality. And it's beautiful also in God's plan, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah. I don't remember saying that, but I don't know that I want my children to suffer, but I guess, you know, it does make sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe God does that for us, that he puts trouble in our life so that we could know him. And know his grace and know him better. The closing the program, we have a question there on our screen. What has been the most effective way to meet people with a secular worldview? To meet people. Well, how do you meet people? So just stop and talk to the first person you meet, and there they are.
Mm. Yeah, I'm not like starting a movement here or anything. All right, I love everything that we do it in as our church and so on. But sometimes like our concept of evangelism can be very like limited.
Mm-hmm.
It's the idea that I go to the street and I talk to people whom I don't know, and I have clear message and I want to lead them to Christ, and this is beautiful. But we should go beyond that. Mm-hmm. Like we should be present in places, in the country where I am, we cannot do that way. We cannot go to. So we go to places where people go, and it's kind of easy there because there is no alcohol in the country, so you don't get into bad places, you know, really, and you don't get into this kind of weird things because it's kind of very moral. The environment and the cultural scene is very moral. So we go to a lot of places, like we go to the opera, we go to concerts, we go to art exhibitions, because that's where the people are. And that's where we interact and mingle with people. But sometimes, you know, church people are kind of like, you know, and I'm not encouraging you to do this, and understand me right, you know.
Sure,
but
sure,
sometimes
sure.
There's like two big gap.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, that yes. We go and reach the people who are like homeless and so on and so on. And we kind of find it secure to reach them because we are coming from above and they need us. But going to the upper class or going to people who are cultural or educated and so on, we don't, because we, you know, for some reason. But I think we should be there.
Okay, very good. Very good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good word. No, I agree. I think we all agree. We have like in our city, Baltimore, I think there's a lot of communication that happens at the working place, neighborhoods, different, you know, health clubs, societies, mm-hmm. groups. So I do think we are integrated in the society, but then how are we talking when we are golfing,
mm-hmm.
and we're with somebody that we, you know, where I'm working at the working place in the cafeteria, and then, you know, how do I start the conversation and how do I talk to people?
Yeah, like I can give you another example of what we do in Muscat, in because we have the art gallery. It's a great platform to meet people, and we meet all kinds of people, not directly like in a religious conversation or so, but we do also, like, for example, we do something that we call art talk, and that means we invite everybody. It's open to anyone and everybody to come in a particular evening. It's not like this. Sometimes in art galleries they do these art talks and it's very high, you know, cultured, like somebody reads from a paper using these really fancy terms and everybody's like looking important and so on. That's not what we do. And I always emphasize that we are doing like non-academic art talk. We are just casual art talk. And it has no agenda. It is not clear what we're going to talk because the gallery has my name, so I have taken that right to decide how it's going to go. So I just monitor there. And usually we have like from 20 to 30 people there. And it's different kinds of people. There are artists who come. There are art lovers who come. There are poets who come. There are sports people who come. Young people especially. And they love it. It's kind of our rap session. That's where I got the idea from. It's like, you know, that it's not so structured and it doesn't have to go in the same way always. But everybody gets involved and a lot of things can be said there. And there's a lot of good exchange of thoughts. And I believe in it. I believe in building that kind of platforms where people can, maybe church has to step over to the church that can be very high and too high.
Yeah,
because people feel that it's too religious, it's too, narrow or something. But it's not so threatening to come to an art talk.
Yeah, no.
Maybe it is to some people, but to some people it's not so threatening to come to an art gallery. And there you are, all of a sudden you are actually almost like in a church service.
Yes,
you just don't know it.
Well, I have seen some of your videos and on these art talks. So you're in front in the pictures or in the gallery.
Yeah.
There's a group of people there and you're just explaining a piece of art and it's very good.
Yeah.
It's very good. It's a way of communicating, you know, heart to heart from, you know, with people.
Yeah.
And people are people everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Amen.
Yeah. Well, that's great. That's it, I think, right, Cody? All right, so thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more. Be sure to join us for our next show tomorrow as we talk about this subject.
Can we give a little app for the Dallas event? Because
sure.
We're going to have a great event on Saturday. If you are in the area of Dallas in Texas, or if you have some friends there, we'll have a one-day art event there from 2 o'clock till 8 o'clock in the evening. And the theme is actually abstract biblical art. So I will have my works there on display, and I will be also present. So welcome. You can get the exact information by contacting us.